jazz. Busted.
Well, if we're ready, it's time for Jazz Bastard Podcast 169. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
And today, I think I'm going to call the podcast Discoveries and Rediscoveries. We're going to do three reissues or issues of music from the 60s. Two of them have been out before, but they were kind of repackaged for Record Store Day events. And then the third one is probably one of the most famous jazz issues of the last few years. We've kind of put off talking about it for quite a while. And I know most other jazz outlets have already discussed it to death, and that is John Coltrane's recently discovered quartet album, Both Directions at Once. This was kind of a lost studio session that turned up and was reissued, I think, in 18 to great acclaim in various versions. The other two selections are both albums that have been out before but have been repackaged. Sonny Clark Trio on Time from 1960. And Sonny Clark's a bebop or a post-hard bop pianist. And it can be a bit confusing because he has an album on Blue Note called Sonny Clark Trio. And that is mostly of standards. But this is a Sonny Clark Trio session on Time. It's all his originals. And the particular issue we got is a LP of the original album and then an LP of alternate takes. And then finally, Eric Dolphy, Musical Prophet, the expanded 1963 New York studio sessions. And what this collection does is reissue two albums that have been out there in circulation in various forms for a long time, Conversations and Iron Man, adds a couple bonus tracks to those, and then adds a whole CD of unissued official studio recordings from those sessions. So alternate takes there. And that was a Record Store Day special that I think the vinyl version of disappeared within about 30 seconds of being released, but is available at a reasonable price on CD. So those are the three reissues. I don't know. Do you have a preference of where we start?
Nope.
Okay. Well, let's start with Sonny Clark because it's slightly earlier. Dolphy and Coltrane are both from 63. Sonny's from 60, but he's also working in a slightly less advanced idiom. What do you think about pianist Sonny Clark? Have you listened to much of his stuff?
Like everyone who knows anything about Sonny Clark, I know Cool Struttings.
Yeah, Cool Strut, yeah.
And then I think I have a handful of his other recordings floating around in the old collection. And then the other place I know him maybe best from would be the John Zorn tribute. I think there are two John Zorn tributes to him with, you know, bizarre, kooky instrumentation. I believe Bill Frisell on guitar, Zorn on alto, and I forget who else. I want to say a drummer, but that may not be right. And there's a couple of those John Zorn tributes to him. I have a handful of the Sonny Clark albums, but Cool Strutting is the one that kind of everyone knows. The other one that I kind of know and like is Leapin' and Lopin' with Turrentine and Charlie Rouse on it, which is a pretty cool album. But I know I have, like, probably most people I know three or four of these. But Cool Strutting is one that everyone, that's the kind of famous one that everyone swears by. The date with Art Farmer and the Irrepressible, that's an adjective for him, the Irrepressible, Jackie McLean.
Your favorite, yes.
Yeah, my favorite player. And Philly and Paul Chambers on bass on that day. And that's a great album. I like Art Farmer on that album quite a bit. He is the cool sauce to Jackie McLean's salsa. So it all works out well.
Yeah, that one, I think it's infamous for having gotten a rather mediocre review, I believe, don't quote me on this, on Downbeat, you know, 3 stars or something. And then later, Cool Strutting, kind of its reputation grew as kind of epitomizing hard bop.
Yeah.
Because it is a very straight ahead, 4-song hard bop album. It's been released later with bonus tracks, but the original release was just 2 songs aside. And it is right down the middle in defining that genre. It's just, it turns out, with a historical perspective, it was just an extremely good example of its kind.
Well, and also, I mean, let's face it, it is probably Reed Miles' best cover design on Blue Note in terms of photography. A lot of the Blue Notes feature images of the creators. Cole Stratton's got a pair of legs and high heels.
Right. Yes. It's a very witty photograph. Yeah.
It's a very good picture. Yeah. They eschew the normal. It's usually a black and white photograph that's then toned blue or green or whatever, usually of the leader, not always. And yeah, this is a nice break. It's one of Reed Miles' best designed covers.
If we're sounding sexist here, you got to remember a lot of jazz releases of this era just featured naked women. I mean, this is, it's maybe a little bit objectifying, but it's fully dressed woman's ankles. She's out strutting. It's not quite as explicit as many of these covers were on other labels.
It's, by modern standards, downright demure. But yeah, I mean, it's a famous cover. It's a great cover.
So. It is. Yeah, it's a really good photograph. So Sonny Clark is a great example of a cult artist who kind of, his cult has grown to the point where he kind of is the tail that wags the dog. You can get discs of his work with the Buddy, is it DeFranco or Franco? I don't know why I can't.
I think it's Buddy DeFranco.
Buddy DeFranco. I don't know why my mind is. I think too much of 19 Crimes is circulating in my system right now. Anyway, he was in Buddy DeFranco's quartet, and then now the session's released as, with Sonny Clark, almost under Sonny's name. A lot of his appearances have kind of, everything he did for Blue Notes back in circulation, including sessions that were unreleased at the time. He's just kind of, he died in 63, so he dies very young. He had a serious habit, and that took him as a young man. And again, at the time, he was considered just another stylist, but in retrospect, he's kind of been elevated to one of the great saints of hard bop. And for me, I guess the most distinctive thing about him as a pianist is he likes to play long melodic lines in a solo that go beyond kind of breath points for a horn player.
Right.
He does not break his phrases up the way many piano players do to kind of be closer to the way a human voice or a horn player might articulate them. He goes beyond that, which of course you can do in piano if you have the energy and the dedication, because you can play it forever, right? You never run out of air on a piano.
Another way of putting it is he's just got a great right hand.
Yes, right.
I mean, he's just got a great right hand. Which isn't to say, I did a little reading, and there are people who are effusive in the praise of his left hand, I haven't heard enough maybe of him to agree with that. It's not that he's got a bad left hand. It's just that's not what I listen to Sonny Clark for. It's those long lines you get on the upper register. That's really what I listen to him for. And it wasn't until I read that I was like, let me listen and try and pay attention to the left hand. And I'm like, no, I just want to listen to the right. I just want to hear.
Right. Yeah. I hadn't heard that. He's a good punctuator. It's not that he's bad at it, but it's like Bud Powell with a lot more heroin. He is cooler than Bud.
Yes.
Maybe in certain ways clearer. I mean, he's got very, especially on this session, you can really hear his ideas playing out.
That and he's, unlike Bud Powell, who's always, we've talked about this before, he's like the truck going down the mountain just a little faster than he should, which is
dynamite on the truck.
It's part of what makes Bud Powell so thrilling and exciting is you're like, will he make it? You never have the sense of something clever, will he make it? Of the things we're going to talk about today, this is the one that no one who's listened to jazz could listen to and go, oh, I like that. You need this. This is like starter kit jazz. You can listen to this and go, oh, I dig this. Now, for aficionados who really like this stuff, it's the other things that are going on here besides Sonny Clark that's going to get their attention. I don't know who is in charge of this remastering, but my God, is it beautiful. I mean, it just sounds amazing. You've got Max Roach in my case in your right ear, and you've got mostly Sonny in your left, with just enough George Duvivier in underneath him that you can hear him, but it's not too big. And that seems to be about the right balance. I'm not a big Duvivier. I don't know a great deal about him, but he's not Dick Davis. He's good. You know, he's terrific, but I don't hear him and think, oh my God, I need more. I need that, you know, turn up the bass. He's just good. He's ideal.
Right. He's very accomplished. He's a good, you know, bass player. And I don't want to say the Ray Brown tradition, but just, you know, a fine timekeeper.
He's his big hero was Blanton. He's a Harlem. He grew up in Harlem, and he's a Blanton fan. He doesn't have as big a sound. He's not as omnipresent as Blanton is, but he's just really good. He's got a nice round tone. He's good. You know, I don't know what else to say other than I like him. But no, I just love the mix, the balance here, especially with Clark in one ear and Max Roach in the other. This just works out really, really, really well. And it sounds fantastic. This is just a straight ahead bop date. It's a straight ahead trio bop date with three really good players playing Sonny Clark originals. And Clark is in fine form. I actually thought, I don't know if these are placed on the on disc one. I don't know if they're placed in the order in which they were recorded. But Minor Meeting sounded a little bit like Sonny wasn't quite awake yet. It just sounds a little stilted, but then thereafter, especially Nika, the second cut, we're grooving. Everything's like in place. So yeah, I found this just really enjoyable straight ahead hard bop date. Maybe to a non-jazz person this would be challenging, but to someone who, you know, if you've listened to a lot of jazz, this is going to just seem really easy and familiar, and you're going to like it. You're going to listen to it and go, oh yeah, I like that. You're going to grok it immediately. Max Roach is in very fine form. He's not overbearing. I think that he and Clark are good foils for one another. I think Clark leads into his solos really nicely. They trade fours sometimes. It's a nice date. It's really good. Very enjoyable, very easy of access. If you're a big jazz fan, you should have this. If not, this is good starter kit jazz, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that of the two trio sessions, I'd go for this one before Sonny Clark Trio and Blue Note.
Yeah.
The Sonny Clark Trio and Blue Note's got a gorgeous cover of kind of different colored bars there representing an abstract piano. It's this lovely abstract art. The original Time release of Sonny Clark Trio and Time was just, it looks like a murder scene. That's what I describe. You know, right. It really looks. But this reissue's got a studio picture of Sonny there. And it includes the version I got. I'm not sure there's another version. This was on Tompkins Square. It has a second LP that's all alternate takes. And there are two takes of Nika, two takes of Minor Meeting, and then Sonia and Junka, both one other alternate take. But they do spread them across the LP, so you're not hearing the same song over and over again.
Right.
And then the original LP is eight tunes. And so I think, yeah, they did their very best to kind of clean this up sonically. I think it sounds gorgeous. And if you want to get to know Sonny as a player...
Yeah.
It's a great place. And as a composer, because these are all his tunes, and that's really not the case on most of his LPs. Normally there's at least a standard thrown in or somebody else's tune. And of course, most of his stuff is with horns, so you don't hear as much Sonny as you do here.
Yeah.
Yeah, Roach is interventionist, creative, but not, as you say, overbearing.
And he can't, you know, he can be.
Oh, yes, yeah.
You know, and he's not here. It seems like he and Sonny have kind of a truce, and yeah, they play off one another really well.
Yeah, and it is a quintessential hard bop piano trio album. You know, you're not going to listen to it and think, oh, Sonny Clark was the next Art Tatum or something. He's just got a very clear line. He's got very, especially in this session, you can hear him thinking through his ideas. I mean, it's not quite Thelonious Monk level, but it's very legible. It's very easy to follow. And again, he's got that very distinctive long line. And now, of course, just anything he's on, people are kind of collecting and thinking about. Those who love the hard bop era, he's become kind of one of the minor saints. But this might be a good entryway into his stuff. And then you might start being able to hear what he contributes to sessions where he's not as prominent. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. The pressing is well done. If you're worried about it, this LP may still be floating around. I don't think Sonny's name was big enough that it kind of disappeared right away. But it was, it's a fine way. And I think if you get it on CD, you're fine. I'm sure this is a digital remaster they put on LP. But either way, it's good sounding stuff. Okay, maybe let's save Dolphy for last because it's so extensive and go on to John Coltrane's Lost album, Both Directions at Once. This is with his classic quartet, McCoy Tyner, Elvin Jones, and that bass player. Who is the bass player?
Jimmy Garrison. Oh, my God.
Does it? I mean, do you really think it's Jimmy? Jimmy was the pivot. Jimmy was the key. He's fine. I know. I'm not trying to pick on Jimmy.
No, the pivot, of course, is Elvin. It was always a love affair between John and Elvin. But,
yeah, so this was, this was, I think, a bestseller. This was big news in the jazz world, the tiny
jazz
world.
Well, the Cult of John. I mean, for God's sakes. And they marketed it brilliantly, the Lost album. Reading articles on this, Impulse has something like 85 CDs worth of unreleased material.
Holy crap.
So we're going to be getting a lot of Lost albums. You know, if they just churn out one or two a year, Impulse's founders will be able to send their great-grandchildren to, Ivy League schools in perpetuity, because the people who must have this stuff must have this stuff. So, yeah, the Lost album, give me a break, but I think it was Robbie Coltrane who said, we had to call it something.
There you go.
It's marketing, baby,
Right. Well, and I think it was legitimately, this was recorded apparently the day before he recorded John Coltrane with Johnny Hartman.
Right.
And the tapes just they were not cut to a record, but they were organized in a way they were pretty confident, when they finally discovered like a mono issue that was in Coltrane's archive somewhere. I don't remember the whole story.
I've got the story.
Okay.
It was Bob Thiel at that glorious studio that they had. It was Bob Thiel. I think it's Bob Thiel. I know it's not Reuben Gelder. It's Bob Thiel. It's got to be Bob Thiel.
Well, I think they're both involved in that Thiel was the producer,
right,
and Van Gelder was the engineer.
Right. But it's at that amazing space they had in New Jersey.
Right. Yeah. That was Van Gelder's studio, but Thiel was the one who organized the session,
right,
and apparently was sneaking out. He was like, well, I wouldn't ask my bosses, about recording when I just do it late at night and they say, by the way, we've got another Coltrane album.
Right. He was doing this stuff on the sly. And he gave the masters, or he gave copies of the masters to Coltrane, who gave them to, I guess, his wife, and it was his daughter, I think, Juanita, who found them later.
They gave them to his first wife, Nima, I believe.
Right? Yeah, and then his daughter discovered them, and they're like, hey, let's do this thing. I have to read you. I won't read the idiot's name because he's some punk kid from nowhere. But a reviewer on RYM said the following thing about this album, which is so obnoxiously wrong that it's funny. He said, John Uncoltrane giving me another worthless excuse of an album. His creativity. I'm going to reproduce the misspellings here. His creativity has been so low since the 70s ended. I think death would be the only release from this path of moronic jazz music. Jazz in quotes.
He really has. I got to say, he has been low energy since he fucking died. Slowed him down.
His creativity has been pretty damn low since his death. Hasn't been too creative since he died.
I mean, that said, this is a Coltrane quartet album. listening to it, I enjoy it. I'm also not flabbergasted that it wasn't released. It's not, you know, it's okay.
Parts of this are a hot mess. I'm sorry. Let's just, you know, look, we're always grateful to have more John Coltrane. All right. I'm not going to be one of those people who are like, we must only keep to the, you know, more stuff is good. But some of this stuff is a hot, hot, hot fucking mess. Slow Blues. Okay, this is one of the few times I'm going to say this, you know, because in the Coltrane Quartet, the least interesting member of the quartet, historically, as far as I'm concerned, is McCoy Tyner. I mean, he's a great player, but I just don't think the quartet was about the piano. You know, I don't think it was about what he had to do. Slow Blues, it makes no sense until Tyner comes in and begins to restore order and structure to that 11.5-minute baggy, sloppy mess. It is a mess of a tune. You've got Jones and Garrison trying to kind of lay down a groove, and the song's called Slow Blues, and then Coltrane's doing this modal motivic stuff over it, and it just sounds like a warm-up session. It sounds terrible. It's an awful cut. By the way, so here's something kind of interesting. If you read around, one of the things I liked was I read around some reviews, and it seemed like every review picked out a different cut as the essential cut, you know, on this album, and someone picked out this cut. To me, this is the inessential cut. It's a mess. It's just a mess. It's only when Tyner comes in at about minute 6 and actually begins to play the blues that you're like, oh, that's this is what's that happening. Was. You know, that's what this song was supposed to be. I mean, it just wasn't a good decision to have Tyner sit out at the beginning. You know, if you're going to do that running of scales over, then let's have the bass melody once before you go to town. And it's more like Coltrane's like trying to tune his horn for 5 minutes. And then Tyner comes in, and you're like, oh, that's the song they're trying to play.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is an interesting day, and a lot's going to be said about it. I happen to like the two untitled originals. I like the second untitled original better, 11386, if we have to go by numbers, in part because it's a major key, bright, happy moment. And there aren't enough of those in the Coltrane, in what people worship by Coltrane. Never get tired of hearing Nature Boy. It's a very short take on Nature Boy here. Impressions also is nice. For me, the two highlight cuts would be the untitled original 11386, kind of a peppier bit, and then the closer, One Up, One Down, only because Elvin Jones is just, he just goes off. I mean, he often goes off, but he really goes off on that particular, he and Coltrane really, they ignite sparks on that particular number. I really like that one quite a bit. But yeah, there's nothing here to me that you're going to say, if this wasn't found, it would be a net loss in the world of jazz. But having it is a good thing, right? And I fall in between that. It's like, oh my God, this forces us to reevaluate the entire canon. No, it doesn't. It doesn't do that at all. Is it good? Yeah, it's good. Coltrane had done a bunch of commercial stuff just before this or around this. The Hartman date, he'd just done the Coltrane with Duke Ellington date.
Right, right.
And he did another commercial thing right around this time as well. I forget. He did three commercial kinds of things. And in part, he had even said in interviews, he was kind of trapped a little bit by the success of My Favorite Things, because that made money. And
he does play it live. I mean, that stays in his book for a long time. So
yeah,
he did,
I mean,
completely.
He knows what the moneymaker is. And apparently he had told some interviewer, you know, I'm kind of looking for another My Favorite Things. You know, I'm auditioning peppy songs. You know, what else could I do? What would fit here?
He does like the inchworm on Coltrane.
Inchworm,
yeah, he's looking around.
Jim Cherie, he does.
Oh, you know, yeah.
That's not too bad. Someone wrote somewhere that Villia might have been, you know, a kind of Coltrane auditioning another peppy song to see if he could do something with it. You know, he should have just stuck with, like, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein or whatever, you know.
There you go.
But whatever. This is, you know, it's not essential, but I'm glad we have it.
Yeah.
And, you know, like all of Coltrane's, not all of Coltrane, like much of Coltrane, it's uneven. You know, the highs are high, the lows are pretty low. When he's experimenting, you know, Slow Blues is just not a good song. It's just not.
Right.
I don't care. It's not that everything Coltrane played is gold. It's not. Some of it isn't gold. And that's not gold. But yeah, I'm glad we have it. And it sounds, you know, it's been remastered fine. I'm interested in hearing more of the stuff as they begin to find, you know, they pull these things out of the Impulse vault. So I think it'll be cool to hear some of this stuff. But I have to tell you, and I'll say more about this when we get to Dolphy, more Coltrane, I don't think is going to illuminate the corners of Coltrane's legacy. More Dolphy will, but more Coltrane won't. I mean, I think what we know about Coltrane isn't going to be substantially changed by more documentation filling in the gaps
right.
of all the stuff he did. I read something, and it sounds just about right to me, that he was very much like Ellington in this way. The guy just recorded everything. He just recorded constantly. And there's a ton of stuff. You know, he just kept working out ideas. He was an obsessive, and he kept going at it. And having more of the stuff isn't going to change what we think of him. But I'll be glad to hear it. I'll be glad to hear some of the variations. It'll be cool to have that. Dolphy, on the other hand, we can't have enough of.
Well, right. He's much less documented. And I guess both of them were kind of obsessive practicers. Sonny Clark, I don't know that he ever practiced. He may have. I mean, he's a fine player, but you don't get the sense. He certainly doesn't give you the impression
of
somebody.
He was too busy scoring. He might have been
He was like agonizing over scales. He's like, whatever, fucker. I'm going to go ride the old horse again. And, you know, but it's just, and part of that's part of his charm is that he's laid back, whereas Coltrane, of course, very intense. Yeah, one reason I did not get this sooner was I figured, I'll get this on LP, and I kept running across the 2LP version of it
right.
with alternate takes. And that's kind of where I get off the train. I don't,
You don't need the alternate takes of alternate
takes? Yeah, I didn't mean to make the joke about train. I get off the train, I get off the bus, whatever. I don't want. Yeah, I was not in the market for further alternate takes of this session that obviously everybody at Impulse and Coltrane were not impressed enough by to release, because that's why it's the unknown album, right? It didn't disappear. It wasn't stolen by gypsies. They just listened to it and said, well, let's see what happens tomorrow. And what happened tomorrow was Johnny Hartman's album, which is a, you know, all-time classic. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. There are times I think maybe I almost like Woody Shaw's version of modal jazz better than Coltrane's. I know this is a blasphemy, but I almost kind of like where he took it and burnished it just on an album by album, track by track basis, at least as much almost as Coltrane. And, you know, I love Coltrane. I don't love him as much as his great disciples. I don't.
Yeah.
You know, he's not as central to me. And I like him a lot. But he's not as central to me as he is for some people. And there are times I'm listening to this, and really the whole album is like him doing stuff that he's done elsewhere as well or better. But
yeah,
it's still pretty fucking good. And I've enjoyed it, and it's kind of neat to hear him. He didn't do Nature Boy that often. He didn't do Villa very often. Sure, I mean, I'm very happy they found these, but yet these are not the master key to who Coltrane is. And if you don't have a great majority of his Impulse records that came out during his lifetime, certainly begin there. This is not, I would not begin with this.
No.
Because it's just not him at his best.
I have two other things to say. One is the cover, a great photograph, and I think it says a lot. I did not know this is how they configured the band in the studio, but you've got Coltrane facing Elvin Jones on the drums across the room, which you need Elvin Jones to be across the room. And then and then between them, you have Garrison and then McCoy Tyner, and Coltrane sitting near the end of Tyner's piano, and Garrison's between Tyner and Jones. And that kind of makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, because Coltrane's really in a dialogue with Jones much of the time. And the other two players in the quartet are almost sometimes like mediating forces between this sort of clash of titans. And that, you know, Coltrane organized, or maybe it was just his occasion, you know, but that I was like, ah, that I just think that makes a lot of sense. Of course, that's how they organized themselves. Of course, that's how this looked. You know, I don't know if it looked that way in the bandstand, but
right,
you know,
right.
Studio, that makes a lot of sense. That's the first thing. The second thing was I've been listening to, for whatever reason, the interview cut, you know, the last tour with Miles and Coltrane. They were in Sweden. And there's an interview cut where a Swedish radio guy interviews Coltrane, and he's clearly a fan, but he's a journalist too, so he asks kind of provocative questions, you know, which I kind of like. I mean, it's a very European thing. He says, you know, some people, John, say your music is ugly. What do you say to this? You
know? Right, yeah.
And Coltrane's like, you're saying I'm ugly? And he's like, no, some people say this. I didn't say this. Some people said this. And, you know, Coltrane responds very graciously. Anyway, he asked him, of your albums, I'm badly imitating this guy, which album do you like the best? And he said, in this interview, as I recall, he said, Blue Train. Hmm. I was like, that's interesting. That's the one. That's the one he liked. That's the one where he's like, I think I got some stuff. That one worked out. Everything else has been just the journey. You know, that was where I found something.
Huh.
That's interesting.
I mean, it's a famous record. I've always thought its fame was partially conditioned on the fact it was his main Blue Note release.
Mm.
I like that album. It's all originals. There are some standards on that album. I don't know, as a performance.
He said he liked it. I don't know if he said it was his best, but he said that he really liked that one.
Because I got to admit, I'm tempted, if I was a rich man, I would get Prestige released an 8-LP set of all the tracks Coltrane recorded in like 58. The last year was at Prestige.
Mm.
And that vintage, I like a lot. I mean, I like more than I think a lot of Coltrane aficionados. They consider his Prestige stuff second or third tier because it was made to order stuff. There wasn't rehearsal, very few originals, pickup bands. But, you know, in terms of listenability for me, in terms of him expressing himself, I think he's as comfortable and expressive in that idiom as he ever was.
Right.
And there's a little bit less of the sameness that sometimes creeps into the second and third tier quartet stuff where it's, Elvin Jones playing triplets. Yeah. You know, who would have guessed? You know, it's an amazing sound that quartet had, but sometimes it did threaten to become a sound. You know, they had a couple things they did incredibly well. And then they did them a lot. And then, you know, their peaks, obviously, Untouchable, Love Supreme or whatever, you know, just fantastic. But there's a sense that it became routinized at times.
Well, that's why he was so valuable later when he's playing with Dolphy. Dolphy's just the sauce that makes everything better. He's one of those guys. But, you know, he's the ideal foil for John Coltrane. Just ideal in
every way. Oh, I know. And so, I guess we're transitioning and this is the one I got on CD because the LP unattainable, and I'm not that much of a, you know, I would say the Coltrane LP, if you get it in the wild, seems fine. It's well pressed. It sounds good. It's you know, you can get new LPs that are kind of badly done and noisy, but this is not one of those. It's fine. If it's on CD, you're perfectly fine. I doubt you're missing a single thing. The Dolphy set, the three CDs, it comes with in great Resonance fashion. So Resonance Records, we've talked about them before. They're this reissue company that have eventized archival material. They package it very elaborately. They include, in this case, a book that's so thick that it's
like
almost
150
comic.
Pages or something, right?
It's enormous, yeah. And it, as was the case with like the Larry Young and Paris sessions, there's a fair amount of redundancy or peripheral stuff in it that, you know, it's not that it's bad.
You could rename the label Redundance Records.
There you go. But it's a bit like, guys, you were just straining to get this booklet. Yeah, 96 pages. Now that includes track listings and everything. But my God, you know, they don't quite interview Dolphy's babysitter, but if they could, they would. You know, it's just about everybody. So they put this package together. Dolphy recorded some sessions right before he records Out to Lunch, which is his best known record on Blue Note, kind of the pivotal piece that everybody would cite. He records sessions that are released during his lifetime. Conversations comes out. And then after he's gone, Iron Man, all based on these same sessions. And then this includes yet more alternate takes. And it's an incredible lineup of musicians. He's got Richard Davis. He's got Bobby Hutcherson on some of these. Prince Lasha.
Woody Shaw.
Sonny Simmons. Woody Shaw. I mean, it's just, you know, and I would say that I don't know that aside from Dolphy and Davis, who, my God, they just have a couple of more than a couple.
Yes.
Amazing duet encounters. And Hutcherson sounds fantastic. He always does.
Yes.
But this is not a dominant session for him. The personnel changes. There's a couple solo pieces. There's a couple pieces with Richard Davis and Dolphy. They're ensemble pieces. There's one 15-minute experimental piece written by later smooth jazz avatar Bob James, featuring a counter tenor. I'm not making this up. It's real. So it's an interesting package. I think it succeeds in that with three discs, I never felt like it was sticking in place or I was getting bored or I wish they had not included what they included. I don't know about you, but you know, when you have a lot of alternate takes and whatever, sometimes you feel like this is more than you need. But as you were kind of foreshadowing in this case, we need all the Dolphy we can get.
Yeah, I think I'll start with Alone Together. I could listen to a CD of just Dick Davis and Eric Dolphy playing Alone Together 10 times. I could listen to that because it's fucking amazing. I mean, we've talked about him before, but Richard Davis is a fucking god. I mean, he's just a god. And the people he's played with, the list is incredibly long, and it includes people like Bruce Springsteen, for fuck's sake, you know?
Van Morrison, right. He's on Astral Weeks, yeah.
Yeah. But Dick Davis is one of the great, great, great musicians of all time, one of the great jazz bassists. He is a god. There's no two ways about it. That cut, Alone Together, and the alternate take, they're fantastic. It's just the two of them. You'd think, listening to a dude on bass clarinet and a dude playing bass would get really old. And my God, it never gets old. It is fantastic. Those two guys together, and those are 13 and 12 minute cuts. They are fan-fucking-tastic. I mean, they're just amazing. I mean, I don't even know what to call it. It's not even telepathic. It's just two guys who really appreciate each other, who are very, you know, Dolphy is incredibly experimental. Like, he is not afraid to make unlovely sounds. He loves multiphonics. The leaps that he makes are all over the place on the horn. He tortures a bass clarinet. He doesn't just play it. He tortures it. And Dick Davis goes from plucking to bowing. It's just fucking fantastic. They're the ideal foils for one another. After that, the things that I like the most on here, I'll say, I mean, I love everything on this. I think this is fantastic. I love the alternates. I love all three of these. It's fantastic. I love Jitterbug Waltz, especially with the larger instrumentation, in part because it's like Dolphy spreads Dolphy fairy dust over everyone. And everyone plays slightly, it's like everyone's slightly sharp. I mean, they're not. But it's you know, it's this cracked, that song is a cracked song anyway. But everyone sounds like they've had just a little bit too much alcohol before they did the take. It's fantastic. And Dolphy sounds even crazier than he usually does on it. I mean, it's just fantastic. And I love Music Matador. I just can't hear that song enough. I think it is a load of fun. Oh, And that's one of the, maybe the things I want to say the most that I like about Dolphy. Dolphy is fun. There is a sense of joy, of pleasure, of infectiousness, yoked with experimentation. With Coltrane, the experimentation is of a questing, fraught nature. It's a man, and it sounds like a man desperately trying to find the key to a door he can't open. And Dolphy's like, I've got a key. I got a bunch of keys. All I need is a door. He's not even sure if there is a door. He's just like, this is fun. There are stories about how he would practice flute to try and sound like birds that he heard, right?
Oh, yeah.
One has the sense of a man who just loves sound. And there's a kind of infectiousness and joy and pleasure in everything he does. And this 3 CD set captures it. This is Dolphy at his very finest. I love this stuff. The alternate takes, you could argue that the recorded takes are better, but these are alternate takes that are of a very, very high order. Like, you know, sometimes with the Sonny Clark, the alternates, you could put your finger on moments where you're like, okay, that's why they didn't use that
one. Right, stumbling or yeah.
Yeah, with this, they're all good. You could have used any of them. So this is God's plenty. I mean, this is just fantastic stuff.
And they make an album out of the alternate takes in a way that is completely listenable. They don't, yep. It's not like going to school. Okay, you're going to hear Jitterbug Waltz, and then now you're going to hear the alternate of it, because you don't really need to hear that melody twice in a row.
Right.
But when you come back to it on the third disc, you're like, oh, fuck yeah. You know, it's just people have learned over time. It's like, how do you present this stuff so you can actually enjoy it just as a listener, but still get the benefit of it? And it's great.
Yeah, run, don't walk to your CD store and get this if you have any affection for Dolphy at all. Now, if you have issues with players who keen toward the sharp, or guys who like to take leaps up and down the register. Because, you know, I forget who it was. There's some British reviewer who said, this is anti-jazz. Well, he can go fuck himself. I don't know what he's talking about. This is just awesome. I mean, this is right. This is in my happy spot. I love this. But I could imagine for some people, like if Sonny Clark's your happy spot, you know, there are probably people who listen to this and it just sets their teeth on edge.
Well, I remember as a kid, you know, another bass player that, along with Dick Davis, that Dolphy bonded with, was Charles Mingus, right?
Yeah.
And there's this amazing version he does with Mingus of Stormy Weather. As a kid, it was hard for me to get through to that, because like, in a very different way, Ornette Coleman, you know, Dolphy is a vocalizing player. He moves his embouchure around in a highly expressive but somewhat disturbing manner if you're used to some. It's weird because everyone say if he wanted to play with an orchestra, he could do that.
Right.
Incredibly. He practiced obsessively the way Coltrane did, incredibly technically fluent. And you got to remember, he's one of the greatest, maybe alto players, you know, people, he's very, very good. Flute and bass clarinet, he's one of the best jazz players ever on both those instruments. And he was a formidable alto player. I mean, I don't know there's anybody that in their doubles was that fucking good and groundbreaking. I remember reading some, I can't remember who it is. I hate flute, but I still like Dolphy's flute.
Right.
Jazz. They interviewed everybody. They interviewed like Sonny Rollins. He's like, yeah, well, he came up one night when I didn't know him before and I was playing in Max Roach's group. He's like, can I sit in? And they're like, sure. And what Roach would do when somebody wanted to sit in with the band was he'd count something off at like 250 beats per minute. Some unfucking believable. And he's like, Dolphy just played. He was fine. You know, it's, like, no problem. Okay. And it's like, okay, well, this fucker can play. And then he got to know him better. And of course, so Rollins went through that period where he played with Don Cherry. I don't think he ever played, you know, on record with Dolphy. But so Dolphy was like incredibly accomplished. But when he plays bass clarinet or alto, he vocalizes on the instrument. He's pure sound, like you said, bird calls, stuff that is not the symphonic centered pitch. And so it takes a while to let that into your ears because it sounded to me as a kid wrong. You know, he's really sharp, or he's, you know, and it's like, man, what is going on here? This just makes my head hurt. And then eventually it kind of broke through to just hearing it as expression. And then you're like, yeah, him with Mingus or him with Davis is also one of the great things in jazz. That said, 3 a.m, I don't want his bass clarinet poking me where it shouldn't poke me. You know, I've got to be in the right mood. Sometimes I'm not ready for that bass clarinet. It's like, put that thing away, Eric.
I had that same reaction to him on, I remember when I first heard Oliver Nelson's Blues and the Abstract Truth, it's like one of these players doesn't belong here. You know?
Yeah, I wonder who it is.
You've got this sextet or whatever it is.
Beautifully burnished, like, Bill Evans, Freddie Hubbard.
Everyone sounds wonderful, and there's just one guy who's like, he is marching to a different drummer, you know? And I remember first time I heard that, I was like, oh, shit, man. And it took me a long time to grok that record. And now I love it, but when I first heard it, I was like, oh, shit, what's this? God damn. I think we told the story before, but I remember reading somewhere Ron Carter said it was a bitch playing with Dolphy because you had to kind of bend your notes because he was always fucking sharp.
And I assume, I think Dolphy wanted it. Again, I've never heard him. And like, I'm trying to imagine, I keep thinking if this man walked into a symphony orchestra, they would kill him. They'd stone him. But I guess if he wanted to, he could play in pit. You know, it was all about expression. He was Carter a technical monster.
He fit down so hard on the goddamn reed.
But again, he must have been able not to do that when he didn't want to for expressive purposes.
Yeah.
If he was in a, you know, symphony or whatever. Yeah, there's a CD I want to get of like his more commercial stuff where he was sitting in with more commercial bands. And you hear him, he dials it back. He's still Dolphy, but he dials it back. And I mentioned the old Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz a show or two ago. And there's this amazing Mingus cutoff, Mingus. And it's just, you know, Dolphy's known for these intervallic leaps.
Yeah.
And it's just an iconic alto solo. It's just one of the best I've ever heard. It's sort of like Adrian Belew with Talking Heads. I'm like, okay, this is sort of like half noise, and it's also entirely perfect. This is one of the best solos I've ever heard. And yeah, and sometimes I will feel like Dolphy has his crotchets, and I'll hear licks that I feel like I've heard many times before. But at his best, he is just incredible. And these are very good sessions that largely weren't as well known because they were on minor, short-lived labels with very small distribution. And then they got endlessly bootlegged.
Was it like Milestones or something?
Well, one was on FM.
Okay.
And so they talked, so it was weird. They talk extensively about the producer.
Right.
And bass player and record label runner Bill Laswell talks about how this guy, Alan Douglas, was a model for his own endeavors. And then you read an interview with Sonny Simmons or Prince Lasher where they're like, yeah, he didn't want to pay us. We're going to beat the shit out of him. And then Dolphy said, don't beat the shit out of him. And eventually he paid us. So this guy's got kind of a mixed reputation. But, you know, he recorded it. And then I think the record label that Conversations came out on went under the year it came out. And so it did not get distribution. And then Iron Man, you know, I've seen it. These sessions have circulated for years. This is kind of the ultimate version of it, where they cleaned the tapes up.
Yeah.
They assembled the material with great care. They curated it very carefully. And I just didn't get around to sitting down with my headphones and listening to, you know, my old MP3 copy of, you know, whatever, Iron Man, and comparing it to this. So I cannot tell you how much better the remasters are. They sound very good. This is, you know, if you've never gotten these before and you're willing to spend the money or you want to look them up streaming, this is the way you'd want to do it, I'm thinking.
And I would say if you're a Dolphy fan, this is essential. Like, you must.
Right. Yeah.
There's no two ways about it. If you like Dolphy, you must own this. I wouldn't say if you've never heard Dolphy, start here. That would be a mistake. You better make sure you like this stuff. Although I think he's the kind of player over time, unlike, say, I was about to make another obnoxious comment about what's his name, but I'll leave it out. You will like him. Who's the alto player I hate? His name's gone out of my head.
Jackie McLean?
McLean, yeah. Nothing will ever make me like Jackie McLean.
I know. We had a whole episode of Exorcism on this.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you know, I would not start here if you've never heard Dolphy. But if you already know you like Dolphy, you must own these. I mean, this is essential. You have to have this.
And I like Jackie McLean, and I think even Jackie McLean's ghost would agree that, you know, Dolphy was a genius. Jackie McLean was a fine hard bop player with a tendency to run sharp. They're just different levels of ability. Yeah, he is. I'm always thinking, I've now got this image, and I think we'll put it in the book, you know, about what door did you come through to get to jazz? Because I was fascinated. This book I read about Sarah Vaughan, we talked about her recently, was written by a classical music lover. And Vaughn was the door she crossed through to jazz because Vaughn was closest to the kinds of musicians she'd experienced.
Exactly.
You don't listen to Billie Holiday if you've been listening to opera and make much sense of it. You need a way to get to Billie Holiday because she doesn't have the kind of voice an opera singer does, where Vaughn did, but then, you know, used it for jazz purposes. But some of us, you know, the door we go through is Bob Dylan or whoever, the Beatles, and then it may be Billie Holiday and her kind of quote-unquote authenticity is the door you go through because Vaughn sounds too studied, you know, too fancy. So, yeah, Dolphy is, if you're used to pure, tonal, centered, disciplined sound, he may just freak the fuck out of you. And it may be some people just can never bend their heads around the kinds of noises he occasionally makes. But yeah, I'd say that if you can't learn to love him, you'll probably never love the avant-garde, because he's one of the best arguments for the aesthetic worth of the avant-garde.
Yeah.
He's a real deal in this realm. And he could play the fuck out of bop. He could play the fuck, apparently, I've never heard him, out of classical music. You know, he's got a talent stash that is irrefutable. Any musician that met him, like Sonny Rollins, who never sounded the least like Dolphy, knew that he was a real thing. There's a great story. Ornette Coleman said, when I first met him, you know, he kind of thought I was a lesser being and that he was from L.A. and I came up from Texas. But, you know, we got along. We made music because, of course, he invites Dolphy onto his free jazz session. And Ornette's such an interesting human being anyway. But you can imagine, you know, Ornette kind of self-taught, didn't know about keys and instruments and whatever. Dolphy is like, you know, this spoiled only child of this amazing family. Spoiled isn't right. Everybody loved him. They treated him well, but he was extremely warm, lovable human being, right. You know, but, you know, just kind of a golden child kind. And he's meeting Ornette and he's like, he's not even sure Ornette can play the fucking thing. Where what he's doing, he can play three instruments at symphony level practically. Ornette's just, he's a very different kind of phenomena. But they both had that vocalized sound. Yeah, I love this session. They're amazing. I personally cannot listen to like 2 hours of this in a row.
It was great prepping for the podcast because, you know, everything's all mixed together and it was just, you know, and there was 3 CDs of this as compared to the other things. And it was like about half the time I'm listening to Dolphy. Oh, God. Love it. Just love it. I think it's fantastic. That was another thing I was going to mention based on what you were saying. Sort of legendary fact about Dolphy, which is that everyone loved him. The guy had no enemies. Like, he was just a sweet-tempered dude. McPherson told the story on our podcast about, you know, Mingus wanting to, you know, have a knife fight with him, and Dolphy didn't have
right,
a knife.
Right, yeah.
He's like, let me buy you a knife. And he's like,
no, we're not fight, that's not going to happen. Yeah, well, this, you know, this packet that goes on and on, they interview everybody. You know, Alan Douglas, the producer, completely different pictures of who he was from the interviews. Every single motherfucking person they talk about Dolphy, he was angelic. He was sweet. I mean, there's no controversy about that. And he had too much honey in his tea, and he died in Germany because they assumed he was a heroin addict, and he was a diabetic, and no one knew it.
Died at, what, 36, right?
Yeah, way too young. And, man, yeah, I kind of wish it. One of the people they interview is McCoy Tyner, and he talks about Coltrane bringing in Dolphy and how the other members of the band were like, no, this is this thing we've got going. They were not happy with.
Right.
And, of course, that's eventually what broke up the band is when Coltrane brought in a second drummer. It was pretty much the writing on the wall. Elvin was not going to put up with that shit. And, you know, Alice was coming in and whatever. But and then they said, well, they learned to accommodate him. But, you know, that very tight-knit, almost kind of schoolyard thing. They said, you know, Coltrane was the leader. He said, this is the way it's going to be. And, of course, yeah, the sessions he does with Dolphy at the Vanguard are just some of the best stuff. Some of my favorite Coltrane.
There's a live Coltrane in Europe, I think, with, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, we talked about, you're right.
And Dolphy's on like half of those. And oh, my God.
Well, the 7 disc, he's on like a disc and a half. And then
that's right. That's
everything
right.
else is like, it's fine. But it's like, where the fuck is Eric?
Yeah, the one with Eric. Dolphy and Coltrane live are fantastic.
And, you know, and also, you know, you could say Eric was, I'd say in some ways, I guess after Elvin Jones, probably Coltrane's most important sideman. And then he was also Charles Mingus's, you know, I mean, he just, the impression he made on those two towering leaders of that period of jazz, and he's, you know, very different musicians in certain ways, but he's just, So yeah, this is a must. I'd say the three by far. I really like that. If you want to get into Sonny Clark, I would strongly recommend this time trio as a way of getting to know him as a player, But his Blue Note sessions are better known, and they're, you know, they're fine. They're very good, and Cool Strut is kind of a classic.
And you'll find them. I mean, you can find those Blue Note sessions on CD used anywhere. I mean, they're around.
Oh, he's definitely, he has come, he's been in print. He has been canonized after his death, after he was, you know, kind of dismissed as a three-star stylist during his lifetime. And he's a fine piano player. I really enjoy him. Yeah, the album Mike was singing about with John Zorn was Voodoo, the Sonny Clark Memorial Quartet. And Wayne Horvitz on keyboards, Ray Drummond on bass, and Bobby Previtt on drums. And that is a very fine record.
It is.
Zorn's playing is hit or miss for me, but this is good. And he was Zorn, one of the many, many things he was enamored of were the kind of 60s era Blue Note hard bop compositions of people like Sonny Clark and Hank Mobley, which, you know, at the time in the 80s were not canonized, were not that well known. Great stuff. Well, do you have any pop matters on your mind?
Not too much. I'll just tell you what I've been listening to a little bit of lately, which was different things, but sitting down today, listening to Jimi Hendrix, Are You Experienced?
Oh, yeah.
Beginning to end. And
do you always feel slightly embarrassed when that's playing? I guess if you're alone, you wouldn't, but I like...
Right.
In mixed company, like, especially with someone of the opposite sex, it just seems a bit much, but yeah. I enjoy it.
No, but I was just thinking, I like it better as an album than as excerpted singles.
Mm, okay.
Because when you hear Hey Joe or The Wind Cries Mary or Foxy Lady, God forbid, if that's in your car playing loud, it's like you're a cliche. But if you're listening to the whole album, it's sort of, I feel like less of a cliche. it's like I'm allowed to like this if I'm listening to the whole album. But if I just, if you're in the car and Foxy Lady comes on, you need to roll the windows up. If you're a middle-aged man and Foxy Lady is blasting from your car stereo, you are a cliche. I don't want to be a cliche. You know? I need to say loudly to people, no, I've listened to the whole CD.
There you go. It's okay.
I had the whole thing playing. This isn't an AM oldie station. I have the CD. It's good stuff.
Yeah, he's an album artist. I got his, you know, classic Experience records, and I keep going back to them. I think that as a kid, I listened to him as kind of a pop musician and was looking for the hooks, and now I'm more willing to kind of sit in for the long haul, whereas, you know, more experimental or whatever. And yeah, he's amazing. Obviously, we lost him too soon.
I prefer other things by him more. I actually like Band of Gypsies maybe best, but that's, you know, for another day. But yeah, It was the thing that I was listening to just after I started listening again to Paul McCartney's Ram. You know, they came out around the same time. So.
Ram is the one, I don't have a lot of McCartney solo stuff, but I think my sister got it from the Capitol Record Factory, a great sounding LP of Ram. Oh. And that's probably the only McCartney album I like listening to from beginning to end. I mean, it's obviously silly and self-indulgent, but I think it holds up very well. I think it's way underrated in his canon.
It is.
I like it better than Band on the Run.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but it has his best solo vocal ever. What the fuck is that song? Where's it at? I'm looking for it now. It's his best solo vocal, as far as I'm concerned.
Smile Away?
Shut up.
Smile Away.
His best solo vocal is on... Where is it? I'm looking at the album now. Oh, is it Monkberry Moon Delight? It's just...
Oh, right, where he's kind of screaming. And
yeah.
See, the whole record of the very last one about getting laid in the back of a car, you know, just...
Backseat of my car, yeah.
A good record. Yeah, Dr. John passed away.
Are you a fan?
I know you don't like him, and I got it.
Dick, you know?
Yeah. Well, I guess whatever. I always liked the album One Night Late, which I got in some music store in Jacksonville back in the 70s. It is misogynistic, but, you know, it's the one with Women as a Root of All Evil. Money's bad, but it's legal. What a great couplet. What does that even fucking mean? Are women not legal?
I know. Yeah.
Anyway, but so he passed. And so they're playing on the jazz station. Marcus Miller Janelle Monáe's Tightrope. And I'm pretty sure it was Dr. John and vocals. And I'm like, I fucking gotta have this track.
Oh,
it
no.
was fucking awesome. I mean, that's one of my favorite Janelle Monáe songs. I don't know her work as, you know, as well as I might, but it's just, anyway, it was fucking awesome.
I would just like to know Janelle Monáe.
I know. She's a very pretty lady.
Huge crush on her.
Yes, so. She's extremely cute.
If you haven't seen Moonstruck.
I haven't. I did see Hidden Figures, and it was a...
Moonlight.
It was an acceptable educational film.
Yeah, Hidden Figures is okay. Moonlight. She's in Moonlight, and she is otherworldly beautiful.
Yeah, she's a pretty lady.
Very talented human being. From everything you do
in the shortest time you dream. Well, anyway, staying on the Paul McCartney tip, I'll talk about a couple of reissues I've been listening to. So on the podcast a few months ago, I said, well, I listened to the Usher demos of the Beatles' White Album, some of them. I wasn't that impressed, so I wouldn't need to get the set. And then, of course, I decided, well, I'll put it on my wish list. And so Dad got me this set of the White Album remastered by the son of George Martin, Giles
right.
Martin, and
right.
then the Escher demos, which were demos the Beatles cut, I think, in a house belonging to George Harrison, for the record, some of which did not appear on the White Album, and all of which are kind of stripped down mock-ups of what the songs were to become. The difficulty with this LP pressing is that the first album of Escher demos, they cut the hole so badly that the first track, it was so off-center, it would throw the needle off. So I thought, well, fine, I'm just going to have Dad return this and then get a new copy. And I found it today. There will be no new copy. They're out of copies. And so I'm just going to digitize it and send it back. And I won't, you know, like buy MP3s of the first song on LP3 on each side because I cannot dub them. That's why I wanted to return it. Otherwise, beautifully pressed. I mean, just noiseless. And I was struck. I did not expect the remixes to be as different as they were. So they literally took every track of the White Album, I mean, every part of each song of the White Album, and remixed it. It was more than a remaster. The bass is a lot more sexual now. The baritone saxophone on Savoy Truffle, it gets me a little tingly in places I don't want to talk about on air. It's extremely clear. I mean, I'm wondering if this trend towards just pristine clarity in remasters, mainly associated with Steve Wilson from Porcupine Tree, who's done a lot of prog stuff. He's done Yes, he's done King Crimson, etc. In this case, Giles Martin, you know, it's you can hear what's going on in a way you couldn't before, and you can see it's like you thought, well, that was a cool little riff, but it was kind of buried in the mix. I'm going to make it vivid. So at some point, maybe I'll upload these and I'll have you listen to them and see what you think of them. I like them overall. I think some of the most grungy tracks, probably it's the least successful because, you know, it doesn't help Helter Skelter to be clearer. You know, it's kind of supposed to be sludge.
Right.
But mostly they're very, very pleasing and very distinct. I mean, it's kind of, I'm sure people who are bigger Beatles fans than me will want always to have both copies available, but they're great. And then the demos of the demos, I enjoyed them more than I thought I would once I sat down with them, but and there's some songs, again, that I don't have any other version of. I mean, they were not released or they were changed. You know, completely different lyrics on The Jealous Guy by Lennon. This is completely A Child of Nature, a completely different version of that song. Jealous Guy makes more sense, but whatever. So I'm going to dub what I can and return it, and I won't have those, which is fine. It saves a couple inches of shelf space, I guess. But apparently that's gone out of print, or at least Amazon doesn't have any more stocks. You know, I was surprised they made it that limited a run. You think you can sell this for a while. It's Beatles.
Yeah, you think Beatles, you could just sell and sell and sell.
Exactly. You know, and they really, as I said, new LPs I get are quiet, but these are quieter than quiet, and they are just, it's weird. I mean, normally I think of, well, one thing you're giving up with LP playback is, you know, a little bit of clarity. You get warmth. This is just, wow, it's X-ray. So the other set I got is the one that you really want to listen to in depth because you love Kate Bush, right?
Oh, God.
So I did get the first, and it's probably this is where I'm going to stop, the first set of her first four LPs. And I assume Kate herself is overseeing this, but again, just phenomenally quiet, incredibly clear, and maybe even more strikingly redone than
Strident?
The...
Irritating?
Well, look, she's Kate Bush. They didn't
Piercing?
Change her out with, what do you want? You want some late period Sarah Vaughan, sing it four octaves down?
I was going to point out, with the remastering... they would have fixed the vocals. That is, let someone else sing. I don't know.
Sarah Vaughan's like, Heathcliff, come over here. Now, it's some of these songs, I've never heard the vocals as clearly, which again, not something I was expecting from LPs. So yeah, you have to like Kate Bush, and yeah, she sounds like a donkey at the end of some of her. I mean, she is just weird. I mean, one of my favorite records by her, she's like dressed as a bat flitting around. She's insane. She's off the hook on these records. She is just nuts. But I do like them, and they are noticeably improved over my CD copies, which were the English version of the box set, which were already considered the best versions out there. So if you're looking for them, I mean, again, quality control was carefully overseen, as far as I can tell. They are very nice records.
I'm looking for them. I'm looking to avoid them. So
there you go.
As long as I can see where they are.
That's right. No, absolutely. Oops, I slipped into my checkout bag here.
I stepped in some Kate Bush.
Oh, no. God. Anyway, yeah, it's wow.
Not a fan. Yeah, okay.
I know. Well, Never Forever is a great album. I'm sorry, dude.
Ugh.
It is great. But that song about violence might put you on edge. If you can dig Eric Dolphy, think of her as the Eric Dolphy of pop vocals, and you'll be fine.
I think
fine.
Of her as the Nico of pop vocals.
Hey, Nico's pretty fucking awesome. Speaking of a few octaves lower.
I have more Nico than you do, so.
You do. Do you want a little Teutonic despair?
A little Teutonic out of key?
There you go. Well, what do key signatures really matter when all is meaningless? It's all meaningless. All right, well, is that it? Did we cover everything?
That's it. I'm sick of you. I'm done. All right.
I know. And that concludes episode 169 of the Jazz Bastard podcast. As always, you can reach us at mike@jazzbastard.com or pat@jazzbastard.com. You can drop us a line on Facebook, or if you like, look me up on All About Jazz. The podcast can be streamed from www.jazzbastard.com. From Mixcloud, from Stitcher, from Apple Podcasts, and if you prefer, it also appears on All About Jazz. Tune in next time as we do an episode devoted to pop, though pop that kind of crosses over with jazz. We're going to look at works by Ricky Lee Jones, Erykah Badu, Yellow House Orchestra, and Vivian Sesoms. Until next time, take care.